Chapter 17. Blessed with smooth seas and fair winds, the research vessel Atlantis rapidly covered the distance from the Azores Islands and dropped anchor north of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge over a submerged sea mountain called the Atlantic Massif. The seamount rises sharply from the ocean floor about 1,500 miles east of Bermuda and just south of the Azores. In the distant past, the massif protruded from the ocean, but now its flat top is some 2,500 feet below the waves. Alvin was scheduled to dive the next morning. After dinner, Paul and Gamay got together with the other scientists on board to discuss the dive. They decided to gather rock, mineral, and plant samples in the area around the lost city and to record as many visual observations as possible. The Alvin group, a 7-member team of pilots and engineers, was up at dawn, and by 6 o'clock they were starting to go through a 14-page checklist. By 7, they were swarming over the submersible, checking its batteries, electronics, and other systems and instruments. They loaded still and video cameras on board, along with lunches and extra warm clothing for the pilot and scientists. Then they placed stacks of iron bars on the outside of the hull to make the submersible heavy enough to sink to the bottom. The Alvin's trip to the ocean floor was more a free-fall descent than an actual dive. When it was time to come up, the submersible would drop the ballast weights and float to the surface. For safety purposes, the manipulator arms could be dropped if they became entangled, and if the submersible got into trouble, it could jettison the fiberglass outer hull, allowing the personnel sphere to rise to the surface on its own. If the submersible got itself into dire straits, the crew had 72 hours of life support. Paul Trout was a veteran fisherman who understood the quirky nature of the ocean. He had checked the weather reports, but he relied mostly on his own instincts and experience. He surveyed the weather and sea conditions from the deck of the Atlantis. The deep blue sky was unmarred by clouds except for a few wispy mare's tails, and he had seen rougher seas and a bathtub. Conditions were perfect for a dive. As soon as it was light, the dive team had dropped 2 transponders to the ocean floor in the general area of the Alvin's dive. The transponders sent out a ping sound that allowed the submersible to keep track of its position in a dark world where there were no street signs and the ordinary techniques of surface navigation were practically useless. Gamay stood nearby, engrossed in a phone conversation with Dr. Osborne. They were discussing the latest satellite photos of gorgonweed infestation. "The weed is spreading more rapidly than we calculated," Osborne said. "Great masses of it are headed toward the east coast of the United States, and spots have begun to show up in the Pacific." "We're about to launch the Alvin," Gamay said. "We're in a quiet period, so the water should be relatively clear." "You'll need all the visibility you can get," Osborne said. "Keep a sharp eye out for areas of growth. The infestation source may not be readily apparent." "The cameras will be rolling every minute, and we may pick up something when we look at the pictures," Gamay said. "I'll send photos back as soon as we have something." After Gamay hung up, she relayed Osborne's words to Paul. It was time to go. A crowd of people had gathered on the fantail to watch. One of them was a trim man with salt and pepper hair who came over and wished them well. Charlie Beck was the leader of a team that had been training the ship's crew in security procedures. "You've got a lot of guts going down in that thing," he said. "The SEAL delivery vehicles always made me claustrophobic." "It will be a little tight," Gamay said, "but it's only for a few hours." When it wasn't diving, the submersible was housed on the aft deck in a special building known as the Alvin Hangar. Now the hangar doors opened and the Alvin emerged, moving toward the stern on a set of rails, finally coming to a halt under the A-frame. The Trouts and the pilot climbed a set of stairs and walked across a narrow bridge to the sub's red-painted top, or sail, as it was called. They took their shoes off and squeezed through the 20-inch hatch. 2 escort divers climbed onto the submersible and attached a winch line from the A-frame. While this was happening, a small inflatable boat was launched over the side. Controlled by an engineer on the doghouse, a small room atop the hangar, the A-frame winched the 18-ton vehicle off the deck and lowered it into the ocean with the escort divers still hanging on. The divers removed the line securing the tool basket at the bow end of the submersible, made one last check and said their goodbyes down the hatch. Then they swam to the inflatable to be taken back to the ship. They took their seats in the submersible's tight cabin, a titanium pressure sphere 82 inches in diameter. Practically every inch of the sphere's interior was covered with panels that contained switches for power activation, ballast control, monitors for oxygen and carbon dioxide, and other instruments. The pilot sat on a low raised stool where she could control the vehicle with the joystick in front of her. The Trouts squeezed into the tight space on either side of the pilot, sitting on cushions that provided a modicum of comfort. Despite the tight quarters, Trout was excited. Only his New England reserve kept him from shouting with joy. For a deep ocean geologist, the cramped quarters of the Alvin were better than a deluxe stateroom on the QE2. Since its construction for the U.S. Navy in 1964, the Alvin's exploits had made it the world's most famous submersible. The stubby, 25-foot-long little vehicle with the singing chipmunk's name could dive as deep as 14,000 feet. The vehicle had made international headlines after it found a lost hydrogen bomb off the coast of Spain. On another expedition, it transported the first visitors to the grave of the Titanic. Seats on the Alvin were difficult to come by. Trout considered himself extremely lucky. If not for the urgent nature of the expedition, he might have waited years to go on a dive, even with his impressive NUMA credentials and inside connections. The pilot was a young marine biologist from South Carolina whose name was Sandy Jackson. With her calm, cool demeanor and laconic drawl, Sandy seemed like a younger version of the legendary aviatrix, Jacqueline Cochran. She was a slim woman in her 30s, and under her jeans and wool sweater was the wiry physique of a marathon runner. Hair the hue of raw carrots was tucked under the tan Alvin baseball cap, which she wore with its navy blue visor backward. While Gamay had settled for a functional one-piece jumpsuit, Trout saw no reason to change his sartorial habits for a deep-sea dive. He was impeccably dressed, as usual. His stone-washed jeans were tailored, his button-down shirt came from Brooks Brothers, and he wore one of the large, colorful bow ties that he collected. This one had a seahorse pattern. His bomber jacket was made of the finest Italian leather. Even his silk long underwear was custom made. His light brown hair was carefully parted down the middle and swept back at the temples, making him look like a character from an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. "This is an easy trip," Sandy said as the tanks filled with water and the submersible began its 2,500-foot dive. "Alvin dives around 100 feet a minute, which means we'll be on the bottom in less than a half hour. If we were diving to the 15,000-foot max, we'd drop for an hour and a half. We usually play classical music on the way down and soft rock on the ascent," Sandy said. "But it's up to you." "Mozart would set the proper mood," Gamay said. A moment later, the cabin was filled with the lilting strains of a piano concerto. "We're about midway," Sandy said after 15 minutes. Trout greeted the announcement with a broad grin. "Can't wait to see this underwater metropolis." The submarine continued its descent. While the Alvin sank into the depths, the Atlantis moved in a slow circle above the dive area, and the support crew gathered with the chief scientist in the top lab between the bridge and the chart room where the dive is monitored. Sandy reported their progress with the acoustic telephone, acknowledged the garbled reply, then turned to the Trouts. "What do you folks know about the Lost City?" she said. "From what I've read, it was found by accident in the year 2000. The discovery apparently came as quite a surprise," Gamay said. Sandy nodded. "Surprise doesn't begin to describe our reaction. Shell-shocked would be a more accurate term. We were towing the Argo II behind the ship looking for volcanic activity on the mid-ocean ridge. Around midnight, the second shift leader saw what looked like frozen white Christmas trees on the video monitor screens and realized we'd hit hydrothermal vents. We didn't see tube worms or clams like those found at other ocean vent areas. Word spread like wildfire. Before long, everyone on the ship was trying to squeeze into the control van. By then, we were starting to see the towers. I heard one scientist say that if the Lost City were on land, it would be a national park," Trout said. "It wasn't just what we found, but where we found them. Most of the vents that have previously been discovered, like the Black Smokers, for instance, were near mid-oceanic ridges formed by tectonic plates. The Lost City is 9 miles from the nearest volcanic center. We sent the Alvin down the next day. I understand some columns are nearly 20 stories high, Trout said. Sandy switched on the outside floodlights and glanced through her viewport. See for yourself. Paul and Gamay peered through the circular windows. They had seen the still photos and videos of the Lost City, but nothing could have prepared them for the primordial scene that unfolded before them. Paul's large hazel eyes blinked in excitement as the vehicle glided over a fantastic forest of lofty columns. Gamay, who was equally enthralled, said the columns reminded her of the snow ghosts that form atop mountains where supercooled fog forms tufts of rime on the tree branches. The carbonate and mica pillars ranged in color from stark white to beige. Gamay knew from her research that the lighter colored columns were active while the darker ones were extinct. The towers soared to multiple feathery spires at their summits. Delicate white flanges jutted out from the sides the way mushrooms grow on old tree trunks. New crystals were continuously forming, giving the edges the appearance of Spanish lace. At one point, Sandy slowed the Alvin's descent and the submersible hovered near a chimney whose flat top was at least 30 feet across. The tower seemed to be alive and moving. The chimney was covered with mats of growth that undulated in the bottom currents as if in rhythm to music from the speakers. Gamay let out the breath she'd been holding. This is like being in a dreamscape. I've seen it before, and I'm still in awe, Sandy said. She steered the Alvin close to the top of the tall column. This is where it gets really interesting. The warm water coming from below the sea bottom rises and becomes trapped under those flanges. Those mats you see are actually dense microbe communities. The flanges trap the 160-degree alkaline fluids that stream up the chimneys from below ocean crust that is 1.5 billion years old. The water carries methane, hydrogen, and minerals emitted by vents. Some people think we may be looking at the beginnings of life, she said in a hushed voice. Trout turned to his wife. I'm strictly a rock and gravel guy, he said. As a biologist, what do you think of that theory? It's certainly possible, Gamay said. The conditions out there could be similar to what they were in the early days of the Earth. Those microbes living around the columns resemble the first life forms to evolve in the sea. If this process can occur without volcanoes, it greatly increases the number of locations on the seafloor of early Earth where microbial life could have started. Vents like these could be incubators for life on other planets as well. The moons of Jupiter may have frozen oceans that could be teeming with life. The mid-Atlantic ridge is hundreds of miles long, so the potential for new discoveries is endless. Fascinating, Trout said. Where's the Gorgonweed epicenter from here? Gamay asked. Sandy squinted at her instruments. A little east of here. The Alvin speed is rather underwhelming. 2 knots, tops. So sit back and enjoy the ride, as the airline pilots say. The towers thinned out and began to vanish as the submersible moved out of the Lost City. Eventually, however, the lights began to pick out more spires. Sandy let out a low whistle. Wow. It's a whole new Lost City. Unbelievable. The submersible wove its way through a thicket of towers that extended in every direction beyond the range of the vehicle's bright lights. This makes the original Lost City look like East Podunk, Trout said as he peered with wondering eyes through the viewport. We're talking about real skyscrapers here. That one looks like the Empire State Building. Ugh, Gamay said a moment later. Guess this is the place. Reminds me of Kudzu. They were coming up on a dark green curtain of algae that floated like a smoky pall among the pinnacles. The Alvin rose about 30 feet, passed over the cloud, then dropped back down once they were clear. Funny to see stuff like that at this depth, Gamay said with a shake of her head. Trout was staring out his viewport. That's not all that's funny, he murmured. Am I seeing things off to the right? Sandy steered the Alvin so the full force of the Klieg lights was directed at the sea bottom. "It can't be," she said, as if she had seen a McDonald's on a corner of the newly discovered undersea metropolis. She brought the submersible to within a few yards of the bottom. Two lines of parallel tracks at least 30 feet apart led off into the darkness. "Seems we're not the first visitors," Trout said. "It looks as if a giant bulldozer passed this way," Sandy said. "But that's impossible." She paused and then, in a hushed tone, said, "Maybe this really is the lost city of Atlantis." "Nice try, but these tracks look too recent," Paul said. The tracks went straight for a while and then curved between two towers that soared for nearly 300 feet. At several points along the way, they came upon towers lying on their sides like toppled bowling pins. Other pillars had been ground to powder by giant treads. Something very large and powerful had cut a swath through the new lost city. "It looks like an undersea clear-cutting operation," Trout said. Gamay and Paul worked the video and still cameras to record the scene of destruction. They were at least a half mile into the new vent field. The original lost city was like a pine woods compared to a redwood forest. Some of the towers were so tall that their summits were invisible. From time to time, they had to detour around great blobs of algae. "Thank goodness for those cameras," Sandy said. "The folks on the surface would never believe what we're seeing."
"I don't quite believe it myself," Trout said.
What was that?"
"I saw it too," Gamay said. "A big shadow passed over us."
"A whale?" Trout said.
"Not at this depth," Gamay replied.
"What about a giant squid? I've heard they can dive deeper than whales."
"Anything is possible in a place like this," Gamay said.
Trout asked Sandy to put the vehicle into a slow spin.
"No problem," Sandy said, working the controls. The vehicle slowly began to pivot.
They were in the middle of a tight concentration of towers that obscured sight in every direction. The towers directly in front of the Alvin seemed to be vibrating like strings in a piano. Then two or three of the spires crumbled in slow motion and disintegrated in a smoky cloud. Trout had a vague impression that something black and monstrous in size was emerging from the smokescreen and heading directly for them. Trout yelled at Sandy to put the Alvin in reverse, knowing that it was too slow to evade anything faster than a jellyfish, but the pilot was transfixed by the advancing behemoth and didn't respond until it was too late. The vehicle shuddered and a loud metallic clunk rattled the pressure hull. Sandy tried to move the submersible backward, but there was no response from the controls. Trout glanced through the viewport again. Where an instant before the lights had illuminated a forest of white and beige towers, a monstrous mouth yawned ahead. Inexorably, the Alvin was drawn into the great glowing maw.